Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. The Honorable Luis Arbour delivered a 2008-2009 Judge John O. Newman Lecture on Global Justice on March 23, 2009. Luis Arbour recently completed her term of office as United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. And in 1996, she was appointed by the UN Security Council as Chief Prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda. The title of the lecture is Peace and Justice, a Framework for Peaceful Coexistence.
Thank you very much. I'm indeed extremely pleased, very honored to be giving this lecture and listening to the comparison between the wonderful judicial career of Judge Newman in my modest judicial career in Canada. If I have one regret, is that I didn't stay in a judicial post long enough to get my law clerks to adore me, obviously, to the same extent that they adored you. Apart from that, I have few regrets about having moved in and out of the judiciary in a very uncharacteristic way, but I feel very sorry. I will try to plant the idea in the handful of law clerks I've had over the years that maybe they should do something nice to me, too. Let me first thank Dean Coe for approaching me to share a few thoughts with you today. At least that's the way he put it to me. When I told him, I just wasn't sure that I would have the time to prepare a lecture that would be adequate for such a distinguished audience and in honor of an even more distinguished jurist. Now, those who are familiar with his persuasive skills will recognize the style. Ah, just come, he said. Just come and say a few words. So I had no choice but to pretend that I believed him and now try to struggle to do my best. Now, I look back at notes that I had when I was preparing this talk, and I realized that I did speak here at this law school in April of 2001. I was then a relatively junior justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, and the world, including the legal world, had not yet been shaken by the events that were to take place some 5 months later, and obviously by the response to these events, a response that in many pernicious ways has created severe and lasting damage to the rule of law and to human rights in this country and abroad. For the first time in my professional life, I have been recently deinstitutionalized, and I have therefore regained the full exercise of my freedom of expression. However, the long-lasting effects of years of restraint are such that I cannot think of anything truly outrageous to say. As I moved on in my somewhat disparate career, I became less involved and less agile with the cutting-edge intricacies of law and legal analysis. So what I will try to put to you today is the state of my own reflection on this vexing issue of the tug of war between the imperatives of peace and the imperatives of justice that we seem to have accepted as inevitable. In the spirit of full disclosure, though, I think I must first expose my point of view, as I happen to believe that there is no such thing as a truly dispassionate, universal outlook on these issues. My first discipline was law, not international politics. Within the law, my first discipline was criminal law, and it's fair to say that I came to international law as an accidental tourist, replacing Richard Goldstone as chief prosecutor of the two ad hoc tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda. Before that day, I had never set foot at the UN headquarters in New York, and I don't think anyone in Canada's Department of Foreign Affairs had ever heard of me. Within criminal law, I was never a practitioner. I was an academic and then a judge, which then broadened my exposure to all fields of law. On the bench, I developed a marked interest for constitutional human rights and public law in general. Within international law, my exposure was essentially to international humanitarian law and later to international human rights law, to which I came neither as an academic nor as a judge, but as a sort of institutional practitioner. Now, with this background in place, I would like to put to you some observations and some perplexing questions about features of international criminal law that are, in my view, indigenous to that environment, and therefore that draw very little wisdom from domestic criminal law theory. But I want to make also my best effort to put forward a model that will bring, I hope, a little discipline to the tedious and repetitive debate about the alleged tensions between the ideals of peace and the ideals of justice when international criminal law is activated. The first effort at using personal criminal responsibility for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide after Nuremberg was, of course, an initiative of the Security Council. That made it, theoretically at least, an exercise in the pursuit of peace. That the initiative came from a quintessentially political body may explain why, right at the outset, that imaginative justice initiative was seen as a political tool at the service of, if not subservient, to peace objectives. And yet, interestingly, I would suggest that there was more distance, both in theory and in practice, between the political and the juridical at ICTY and ICTR, the two ad hoc tribunals, at least in their early days, than there is today in either the International Criminal Court or the several hybrid tribunals with which the United Nations is involved. In my 3 years as chief prosecutor of ICTR and ICTY, I never appeared before the Security Council, which had appointed me, nor did I appear ever before the General Assembly. In truth, I did make one statement to the Security Council on my last day as prosecutor on my way to the Supreme Court of Canada, and this was essentially to say goodbye, literally a courtesy call. On one occasion, I received a letter from the legal counsel in New York, in the office of the Secretary General, inquiring on behalf of the Secretary General about my prosecutorial strategy, as apparently questions had been raised with the SG by a representative of a member state. I responded to the legal counsel in what I'm certain was exquisite diplomatic language, that under the statute of ICTY, and I quoted, the prosecutor shall not receive nor solicit instructions from any government nor from any other source. I asserted my confidence that the legal counsel would agree with me that any other source included the Secretary General. Now, let me turn to an even more symbolic event. There has always been an assumption in some quarters that I was under terrible political pressure at the time I issued the indictment against then-President, Serbian President Milosevic. If I was, it was very subtle, and the political message was pretty muddied. Indict? Don't indict? Indict now? Then, if not now, then when? None of that was ever discussed with me, certainly not in any explicit terms. I understood, I think, that NATO allies would have preferred for me to do nothing, if only because they like to control things that happen and they dislike the things that they cannot control. I do not think that they had much idea as to what the consequences of my action would be. I suspect that if asked, they would have predicted that Milosevic would in fact, that they would have never predicted that if indicted, Milosevic would in fact, as he did, capitulate a mere 8 days or so after being indicted, that he would lose power in his own country shortly afterwards, and that he would be arrested and surrendered to The Hague a year or so later. I think this would have been the least plausible scenario, and it in fact is the one that unfolded. Now here I have to pause to refer to a New York Times op-ed by Judge Newman, published on the 29th of May, 1999, shortly after I indicted Milosevic, in which he expressed concerns at the lack of political supervision over the decision of the ICTY prosecutor, yours truly, to issue an indictment, referring specifically to my having just indicted Milosevic. Judge Newman said, and I quote, "The Milosevic indictment reminds us that some law enforcement decision may adversely affect public policy. The timing of this indictment, according to some critics, might cloud the prospects for a diplomatic solution to the war in Yugoslavia." He then concluded as follows, "Indeed, the indictment of Mr. Milosevic could have an unexpected benefit. It might be an object lesson in the perils of making global law enforcement decisions without giving public policy makers some voice." End of quote. Now, I could argue that my independent decision to indict Milosevic on the facts as they subsequently transpired taught us that the fears of adverse consequences flowing from the independent actions of a prosecutor were exaggerated and indeed proved ill-founded. But in case this turned out to be just the one lucky exception, and we have so few to go by, I will try to develop a reasoning of more general application. However, I cannot resist taking issue with Judge Newman's assumption in this op-ed that the political oversight of states, be they members of the Security Council or any other combination of states, would actually be an expression of public policy. I leave for another day the question of whether there is such a thing as an international public interest that could or should guide the decision of international state actors. But as matters stand, I do not think that we can elevate all political decisions in international venues to expressions of public policy. In any event, it's not my intention today to explore in detail the specific question of the independence of the prosecutor in international criminal prosecutions. I'll leave that issue to another day. It's just too hard, I think, is the bottom line, to get into the details of this question of oversight and independence of the prosecutor. So I'd like to approach this issue today much more broadly. Much has been written about the interaction of the pursuit of peace and the pursuit of justice, at least since the great leap forward in the promotion of accountability through personal criminal responsibility on the international scene, starting in the mid-90s. A lot of what has been written, I think is fair to say, champions accountability, and much of it assumes that justice is or should be an instrument of peace. If there's a debate in the literature, it is now cast as a debate between, at the extremes, the so-called justice fundamentalists who are said to make all kinds of unsubstantiated assumptions about the deterrent effect of prosecutions and the contribution that justice will make to national reconciliation on the one side, and then at the other extreme, the real politic apparatchiks who work only for the deal and belittle the pursuit of anything good and moral. In reality, there seems to be a consensus in the more moderate discourse that both peace and justice are highly desirable. On a case-by-case basis, however, there's considerably less consensus about how to accommodate both, and there's no general framework for resolving the tensions, if any, between the two. I would like to explore today two different models of the interlinkage between peace and justice. I will call them, on the one hand, the sequencing model, and on the other hand, the parallel tracks model. Now, I'll just give you a nutshell. The sequencing model, I think, could also be called the justice as a tool of peace model. It accepts the desirability, of course, of both peace and justice in principle, but it sees them as separate. It assumes a link between the two through a political process. It proposes a range of choices in timing, usually peace first, or in processes, including all kinds of things, such as amnesties, reflecting the possibility of justice yielding to the superior peace objectives. On the other hand, what I'll describe further as the parallel tracks model, this model asserts, and this is a bit counterintuitive, but I think it asserts that peace and justice are actually inseparable. It rejects that there's a link between the two that can be managed through a political process, and it proposes to remove justice as a tool in the hands of peace negotiators and insists that justice must follow its own course. Now, let me try to return to these two models and flesh them out in more details. The sequencing model. I think it's fair to say that this is the model under which we currently operate, although, of course, it's never been articulated as such. This model positions itself very much at the outset of peace and justice initiatives. Typically, it outlines possible strategies for peace negotiators who will wish to have a panoply of options to induce the parties to come to a peace agreement. So from that point of view, the threat of criminal sanctions is a useful tool, as long as the threat, of course, can be suspended or even withdrawn altogether. Implicitly, I think it favors peace over justice. Put another way, it would never accept that war be the price of justice, but it concedes that injustice, or lack of justice, for those who think that there's a difference, may have to be the price of peace. Justice is thus viewed as a tool of peace, not in the sense that there can be no real peace without justice, but in the sense that in some cases, prosecuting war criminals may be conducive to peace, and in other cases, not. For example, under this model, justice could serve peace interests through specific deterrence, i.e. by removing warmonger from the future political processes, or by denunciation of their past conduct as a form of atonement, or by retribution whereby the legal process will replace the need for vengeance and thus avoid further warfare. But this model obviously also accepts that the untimely pursuit of justice can be an impediment to peace. War criminals might be unlikely to sign peace agreements that include their own prosecutions. The prosecution process could inflame public opinion in support of war criminals and lead to retaliation against peacekeepers. The cost of prosecution could divert resources from other initiatives essential to the peace-building process and so on. So under this model, even though in principle both peace and justice are accepted as desirable social goods, justice can be made subservient to peace, but not vice versa. And justice is desirable only if it fosters peace, the determination of which is case-specific. So this model, therefore, puts justice in the toolbox of peace negotiators. At the time that peace talks are underway, the criminal process may be a distant option, or it may already be very far advanced. When the prospect of criminal accountability is remote, the task of the peace negotiators is obviously easier without the criminal process losing all of its relevance. Experience so far suggests that the threat of accountability may already serve to minimize the perpetration of war crimes. For instance, I believe that more lawyers are involved today in advising military commanders on the legality of a proposed military action than was the case 10 or 15 years ago. In the case of NATO operations in Afghanistan or of the Israeli Defense Forces strikes in Lebanon or in Gaza, the actual prospect of prosecution for war crimes may be remote, either nationally, before an international venue, or in a foreign state under the principle of universal jurisdiction. But I believe that the potential for accountability has already triggered an appropriate preventive response. Not all belligerents, including non-state actors in internal conflicts, will be equally responsive to the threat of various degrees of remoteness of personally facing criminal charges. And it will not be possible to develop much empirical evidence of the deterrent effect of international criminal justice until, of course, there's a sufficient critical mass of investigations and prosecutions to bring an air of reality to the prospect of accountability. But suffice it to say two things at this stage. Deterrence is not the sole objective of criminal law, and criminal law is not redundant when it doesn't deter all potential deviants. General deterrence is particularly difficult to measure, and in general, in my view, it's one of the weakest foundations for the use of the criminal sanction. At the other extremes, when the international criminal process is far advanced, the clash between the interest of peace and the interest of justice becomes more acute. The actual indictment of political or military leaders such as Charles Taylor of Liberia, President Bashir of Sudan, or Joseph Kony of the LRA in Uganda, even if welcome on moral or even on legal grounds, is rarely applauded by potential peacemakers as a useful tool in the pursuit of their objectives. Unless, of course, they can control the fate of the indictment. The provision in the statute of the International Criminal Court, which creates a link between the Security Council and the court, reflects perfectly this model. As you know, it permits the Security Council to refer a case to the ICC, which one has to assume is premised on the assumption that justice will be instrumental to peace. And it also permits the Security Council to request a deferral of ongoing investigations or prosecutions, presumably on the converse assumption that the unfolding of the justice process is adverse to peace interests. I think it may be useful to unpack the first assumption. What does it mean when the Security Council initiates a justice process, as it did in creating the tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda, and what it did again in referring the Darfur case to the International Criminal Court? International criminal justice addresses war crimes, not war itself. The threat of prosecution may deter further perpetration of war crimes, but not the continuation of the pursuit of war itself. The distinction is easily blurred when, as in the case of Darfur, the military operations are so disproportionately targeted at civilians that there are, in fact, more war crimes than there's war itself, i.e. just engagement between legitimate combatants. But the distinction is otherwise useful. Waging war is not a crime. When a peace process is initiated and the cessation of war is at stake, the commission of war crimes is subsumed in the larger objectives. In other words, if war ends, so will war crimes. So the efficacy of the threat of prosecution to prevent war crimes ceases to have much relevance and becomes, in fact, a real nuisance when it appears to stand in the way of the cessation of war altogether. Accordingly, the criminal justice process for war crimes will very rarely be a priority for peace negotiators. At most, they may agree to explicitly provide that no amnesty will be granted for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in any deal sponsored by the international community, as I believe they are required to do, and as the United Nations now invariably does. If the justice process is already launched, as you will remember in the case of the Lord Resistance Army in Uganda, peace negotiators typically search for a range of options to trade it away. Interestingly, in the case of the LRA negotiations, no one is actually advocating, at least publicly, that there should be no accountability whatsoever. Not that this would necessarily be an unpopular option, but the legal reality is that Joseph Kony and others already indicted by the ICC, and that reality means that there are fewer tools in the toolbox. The only option, and even this one is not fully in political hands, is the choice of a national prosecution rather than one started by the ICC under the principle of complementarity. But I have no doubt that if the existence of the ICC indictment had not already narrowed down the political options, the preferred course for some would be, if not actual amnesty for war crimes, which the UN, as I said, could not support, then at least silence and inaction on the justice agenda in favor of a political settlement for the cessation of LRA activities. In short, therefore, the sequencing model is a more political than a juridical model, and it clearly prefers peace to justice, although it purports to like both. Now let me turn briefly to what I have called the parallel tracks model. This model assumes not that justice should be an ingredient to peace, but that it is. In that sense, the two are inseparable. At common law, a crime is a breach of the peace. A police officer is called a peace officer. We have justices of the peace and peace bonds, promises to keep the peace, in part by not committing crimes. At the same time, the unfolding of the criminal process is not always peaceful. It can be violent. Lawful arrest may include the use of whatever reasonable force is necessary in the circumstances, including lethal force. The trial itself is at times very disturbing for victims, for witnesses, for family members who must relive traumatic experiences when they may well have chosen to be left alone or to be left in peace. When justice is viewed as integral to peace, it understands that peace is not just the absence of raging conflict. It is also a sense of security restored, which subsumes the need for revenge in the appropriation of the harm by the community at large and in the solidarity expressed with the victim. It is also a reaffirmation of a commitment to a peaceful resolution of conflict and to results that are accepted even by the losers because they rest on largely acceptable processes. Without doubt, this model rejects that the link between peace and justice, a very intimate link woven into the fabric of society itself, should be handled by political actors or put at the service of political interests. In fact, it does exactly the opposite. The justice agenda is insulated from political interference, even in parliamentary democracies where the chief law enforcement officer, the Attorney General, is an elected member of parliament and a member of cabinet. In such cases, sophisticated measures are put in place to ensure the independence of the justice track from the political one. Not because politics are bad and judicial processes are good, but because of the fundamental requirements of the rule of law, including the constitutional imperatives of separation of power and the ideals of equality under and before the law. In fact, one of the greatest challenges for the implementation of international criminal justice is precisely the absence of a similar international governance structure in which courts will occupy proper place alongside a real executive and legislative branch. Yet adapted to its international context, justice can, in my view, and should strive to maintain the sine qua non of its integrity while adapting to the governance structure in which it is required to fit. The parallel track model, therefore, proposes to remove justice as a tool in the hands of peacemakers and insist that justice follow its own course. Under this model, the decision to issue, to stay, or to withdraw an indictment is not to be a matter over which politicians and diplomats are expected to exert any influence. It's simply part of the reality within which the negotiations will have to be conducted, including the suitability of indicted war criminals formally acting as peace negotiators. I should add that they would be suitable, in my view, if their unsuitable if their interlocutors were under a positive duty at law to arrest them. Otherwise, although there may be other impediments to dealing with indicted war criminals, I don't think these impediments would be of a legal nature. One might argue that the parallel track models simply and inappropriately shift the political implications of justice from politicians, where it belongs, to prosecutors, where it doesn't. There's no doubt that prosecutorial discretion occupies center stage under this model, and that its exercise involves considerations that could be said to be of a political nature. But in my view, these considerations are different from the political factors that would require a trade-off between the dual objectives of peace and justice. The prosecutor is always required, in my view, to exercise his or her discretion in the interest of justice. The timing of an indictment can be validly determined by the likelihood of leading to a successful arrest, which in turn can be determined by assessing the political will to perform the arrest as and when the indictment is issued. In an environment where prosecutorial discretion is vast and encompasses a selection of prosecution targets amongst the many who could be convicted if charged, but who cannot be charged for lack of resources or for a lot of other valid reasons, the room for improper political consideration is there, and the assumption that politics will play a part is indeed very difficult to rebut. But this, I think, is a subject for another talk, another day, dealing with oversight of prosecutorial discretion. In my view, we have collectively bought into the sequencing model, in large part because of the history of the first ad hoc tribunals and the statute of the ICC, which have assumed a political role in the administration of criminal justice that may, I think, for the time being, be irreversible. If the Security Council continues to launch ad hoc initiatives, as in the case of the Tribunal for Lebanon, for instance, as long as it has the capacity to refer cases to the ICC, it will be difficult to develop a framework that insulates the international criminal justice environment from political consideration. Under the parallel tracks model, there's no doubt that two highly desirable features would be, one, universality in the jurisdiction of the court, and two, prosecutorial discretion properly circumscribed by law as the sole method of initiating proceedings. If in principle the parallel track model is the preferable one in the longer term, one could then advocate measures that would blur some of the distinctions between the two models and minimize the adverse effects of the possibilities for political overlap under the circumstances as they currently exist. Now, this would require a detailed analysis of the desirable contours of the discretion of the prosecutor and of his or her independence vis-a-vis many actors, including the judges of the ICC and the registrar and the Assembly of States parties and the representatives of the Secretary General and other envoys. This could include the articulation of public guidelines for the exercise of prosecutorial discretion, as well as the development of guidelines for the exercise by the Security Council of its referral and deferral role under the ICC statute. As a starter, I would suggest that there should be a virtual firewall between the prosecutor, indeed between the whole of the International Criminal Court, and the Security Council. The problem with the role of political actors in the unfolding of international criminal prosecutions is that it makes clear that if the judicial process can be interrupted for political reasons, it follows that it can also be activated for political reasons. And in my view, this taints the justice enterprise at its core. And frankly, to speak the language of the so-called realists, I think that to introduce criminal accountability options into peace talks complicates rather than facilitates the work of peace negotiators. This is so, first of all, because it purports to put on the table elements that cannot be negotiated solely as the parties might wish, particularly when institutional initiatives, such as an indictment by the ICC, have already been launched. Worse still, putting criminal justice options on the table could put the negotiators in the position of having to condone unjust, if not unconscionable, deals. For example, under the existing situation, when an indictment has already been issued at the time that peace negotiations are launched, negotiators would be very well advised to state clearly the limits of what is feasible in withdrawing charges. Even when a possible deferral by the Security Council could be on the table, it should be stated for what it is, a temporary suspension of the proceedings for up to 12 months renewable and not an actual shield against prosecution. And as for the party's potential preference for national prosecutions, as seems to be the case in the Uganda LRA discussions, it should also be made explicit that the decision on that issue is the sole prerogative of the International Criminal Court. Now, it's beyond the scope of my talk today to analyze in detail the role of the Security Council in referrals and deferral requests to the ICC. As I've indicated, under a better system, the Security Council, in my view, would have no such role. Referrals are, of course, useful since they allow the ICC to be seized of cases that would otherwise not fall within its jurisdiction. But since, of course, there's no real possibility of the referral of a case against the five permanent members of the Security Council or their protégés, there's already a serious affront to the interest of justice built in to the referral concept. As for deferrals, in my opinion, it's difficult to conceive of a circumstance where it would be appropriate for the Security Council to defer a mere investigation. The imperatives of procuring and securing the evidence in a timely manner should always trump the fear that the continuation of an investigation could legitimately impede the pursuit of peace. If anything, this proceeds on a presumption of guilt that those seeking the deferral should want to avoid. As for deferring a prosecution, as you know, is currently being discussed in the case of the indictment against President Bashir, those seeking the deferral the statute prescribes no condition and gives no criteria for the exercise of that prerogative. On the one hand, one could assume that being the prerogative of a political body, it should rest on political considerations. On the other hand, one could argue that as a step in the unfolding of a judicial process, it should be exercised at least in a quasi-judicial manner. That is, for principled, expressed reasons that are consistent with the objectives of the statute of the ICC and not designed to sabotage them. In that way, for instance, a deferral could be requested for reasons similar to the reasons that could trigger a referral by the Security Council to the ICC. such as that the parallel tracks of peace and justice have experienced a temporary overlap. The power of deferral is not a power of amnesty. I would suggest that only when a real peace deal is underway and when a delay in the prosecutorial process would be necessary to facilitate the completion of a peace agreement should a deferral by the Security Council be seriously considered. And frankly, I think there would be very few such circumstances. Those allegedly seeking delay are most likely really seeking a withdrawal, or better still, a total dismissal of the charges. And this is not open to the Security Council to grant, nor, frankly, is it open to the prosecutor at his or her sole initiative. Once charges are laid, the matter is in the hands of the court, which cannot and should not be brought in directly or indirectly into the political discussions regarding a resolution of a conflict. Much could also be said about the independence of the prosecutor, and quite a bit has already been written about the existence of his or her discretion and the checks and balances necessary to enhance confidence in the professionalism, the integrity, and the sound judgment of the prosecutor. The question here is not to debate whether the prosecutor has or doesn't have a political role. It's often pointed out that an international prosecutor operates in an intensely political environment. Surprisingly, it's not often pointed out that the prosecutor operates in an intensely criminal environment. Yet when investigations are launched into massive killings, torture, rape, and persecutions of all sorts, it may be a little more difficult to obscure that criminal reality. But even then, and worse when prosecutions are said to be of a more technical nature, say war crimes rather than crimes against humanity, it's easier to revert to the perception of the issues being first and foremost political rather than justiciable. And this should come as no surprise, considering how recently we have initiated this recourse to personal criminal responsibility for international crimes. We have not been engaged in that complex exercise for very long, but it is, in my view, as where we stand today, irreversible. But it has a long way to go before international criminal law finds its proper place alongside conflict resolution efforts and alongside the many other initiatives related to social justice that are necessary to lay the foundation of better, more peaceful, more just, more equitable societies. The worst we could do is to expect more of international criminal law enforcement than we do in a domestic environment. Actually, maybe the worst would be to expect less. To expect that it has to be politicized, that it cannot be as good, and that it has to compromise, I don't think is acceptable. But we need also to understand the truly unique indigenous environment in which international criminal law operates, and we must design norms, standards, principles, and rules that are suited to that environment and that do not simply mimic even the best of what we have refined in any particular national criminal law system. Let me just conclude by reminding you that on July 14, 2008, the prosecutor of the ICC applied for an arrest warrant against President al-Bashir of Sudan on charges of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And the arrest warrant was issued actually by the court on March 4th of this year on some of the charges, but not including the charge of genocide. In response to an op-ed that I wrote in the International Herald Tribune on last fall, on September 17th of 2008, in response to that, the government of Sudan issued a statement in which it said, and I quote, "It is difficult to believe that, with her experience, she is serious in claiming that justice and politics can be compartmentalized and divided. They cannot," close quote. I assume that the government of Sudan prefers the political realm to the judicial one and prefers, above all, the primacy of the political over the juridical. I wonder what the victims in Darfur would prefer and who will speak for them at peace talks or in the Security Council. Thank you very much.